It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Toppling Goliath, Millstream, Back Pocket, Confluence, Lion Bridge, Peace Tree. Now, if you recognize any of these names, it's likely you or someone in your family is a craft beer lover. Craft beer production has been growing by leaps and bounds all across the country with double-digit sales growth year after year, also here in Iowa. So this hour, an update on the business of craft brewing in the state. Later in the hour, a big picture look at the economics behind locally produced and consumed products, including, of course, beer, wine, and hard liquor. That with economist Dave Swenson. Also a conversation with Iowa's Minister of Beer, so-called Minister of Beer, Jay Wilson. Well, let's start off, though, by taking a little trip to a 26,000-square-foot former lumber warehouse in Iowa City. Well, I've just walked into the Solon-based Big Grow Brewery's second location. It opened here in Iowa City just a few weeks ago. It's much, much larger than their first location in Solon. And I'm standing with the two gentlemen who will take us on a tour this half hour. Andy Joint is the head brewer with Big Grow Brewing, and Danny Stanley is the managing partner here. Thank you for making time for us, gentlemen.
Thank you for having us.
Okay, so what we're standing in right now used to be a lumber warehouse that was converted. So you've got a lot of space to work with. I understand about 26,000 square feet. Tell us where we are and what we're looking at right now.
So we're standing in the brewery right now, and this is all the production space here. This is about 17,000 square feet. A lot of it is currently open. We do have a lot of stainless steel tanks back here that are up to the ceiling. But we have a lot of room to grow should we need to.
And just to give listeners an idea, you've increased your production capacity here by how much, from what to what?
It's about 10 times more than it is in Solon. All the vessels, all the fermenters and the brew house are all about 10 times the size. But ultimately, if we kept growing and adding tanks, we could get much larger than 10 times the size of Solon.
Okay, so what we're seeing here in this large warehouse section, there are what I can only call our fermenters. I don't know that much about brewing on this scale. So we're seeing fermenters, two-story high fermenters, right? How large are these?
So they're about 14 and a half feet tall and about 7 feet in diameter. They hold 1,800 gallons of beer, or it would be about 120 kegs worth if you were to look at it that way.
So Andy, I wonder if you can take us sort of from beginning to end. What are the raw materials that come in, the grains that come in, and how it turns into beer right here, and walk around and kind of show us the path of the grain into becoming beer?
Sure. Well, we can start heading back to where two of our main inputs come in. We have about four ingredients that make up our beer: water, yeast, barley, and hops. So as we head to the northwest corner of our building here, we actually have a large silo where we store all of our barley malt.
Okay, we're outside now.
So if you were driving by on Gilbert Street, you would see this silo. It's about 36 feet high, large white silo. It actually holds about 50,000 pounds of barley malt, and that's where all of our base malt would be stored. So the trick is, how do we get that barley malt that's about 150 feet away from the mill, how do we get it from the silo into the mill to grind it so we can use it to make beer? Well, we actually have something that they use a lot in the farming industry. It's called the chain disc auger, and it runs a loop out under the silo. It'll pick up the barley malt from under the silo, and then it'll take it into our mill where we can start to grind it up. So that whole path, we can walk back into the mill room there. It would be about 150 feet. Mm-hmm. I can turn the auger on, and we can run it to pick some malt up from under the silo. It kind of clangs and dings and makes some noise while it's doing that.
All right, Andy, let's hear that auger.
It's basically like a chain that goes through, and it's almost like a poker chip that goes right through the middle of it. So you see the two pipes, one leading in, one leading out. So one of these is completely empty, and one is completely full.
So we're outside. We're going to go back inside, and you've got a handful of barley there, Andy. Where does the barley go from here? It gets ground up, and then what happens?
So once we bring that barley into the brewery inside here, the next step for us would be to grind up the barley so we could more easily extract the sugars out of it.
So tell us a little bit about barley, because you're going to be taking us through a chemical process to produce beer. Barley has sugars in it. What's going to happen to those sugars?
The sugar, though, is contained in the endosperm, which would be inside of the actual barley husk. So if you grabbed whole barley like we're looking at here, you know, it's a little kernel, not unlike a corn kernel. And once you crack that open, you'll actually pop out the endosperm, which is a little white part here, and that would have all the sugar in it that we're trying to extract as brewers.
If you just joined us, Andy Joint is with us, along with Danny Stanley of Big Grove Brewing. We're getting a little tour of the brewery here, the new brewery in Iowa City, roughly 10 times the capacity of the old one in Solon, where they started out just a few years ago. Andy Joint, where do we go now?
So we brought the barley in from the silo. It's going to get weighed by a flow scale here, and then it'll get dropped into our mill, where it'll get kind of coarsely ground up. That'll expose the endosperm we're looking for. After that point, we'll collect the entire batch's worth of barley that's been ground up, and we're ready to start our brew cycle. So if we take a couple steps over this way, we would get to our brew house. And the brew house is where all of our hop processes would take place. So the first step is in the mash tun here. That cracked barley would fall in, and we would start to hydrate it with hot water. Once we get it nice and hydrated, we would let it steep in the mash tun for about an hour, and that will just make it easier for us to extract those fermentable sugars out of the barley. After that hour is complete, we would start to pull all the sugary liquid out of the barley and collect it into another vessel. So next to the mash tun, we have our kettle. And all these vessels on the brew house are about 30 barrels in size, which they're about 10 feet tall, and 30 barrels is equivalent to 60 kegs worth of beer.
What they look like to me, they could be roughly the size, if you would buy a nice large swimming pool for your backyard, they would hold something like that, probably.
Yeah, I think it'd be a fairly equivalent volume there. Everything in here is stainless steel, though. We need to keep everything very clean during the process of brewing. So stainless steel is the material that we prefer. It's easy to clean, easy to keep clean. So
why is cleanliness so important? What happens if you don't?
Well, as we move through this process, we're producing what we call wort. Wort is basically pre-fermented beer, or you could call it sugar water if you really wanted to simplify it. That wort is also highly attractive to bacteria and that sort of thing. So we have to be very careful as we handle that wort and move it through our process to not let it get infected with anything, as that would cause off flavors in the beer.
So the only thing you want growing here is a yeast that you have selected, and you're making a perfect playground or reproduction ground for the yeast. That's your aim.
You could say that we're actually working for the yeast. I mean, we spend our days cleaning the environment that the yeast will live in and just making sure they have all the nutrients that they need to produce nice clean beer.
And so that they don't have any competitors out there eating their sugars.
Exactly. So it'd take us about an hour and a half to collect all the wort out of our mash tun, and that would fill up our kettle here. Once that kettle got to full, we would bring it up to a boil. Usually we will boil our beers for about an hour, and during that time would be when we would add most of our hops. So we've extracted the sugar out of the grain. That would provide our sweetness in the beer. And then we'll add the hops. That would kind of counter that sweetness with some bitterness to give us a nice balance in the finished product.
Okay, so once it goes from the kettle, where does it go from there?
So we do a few things along the way to kind of make sure we put nice clean wort into the fermenter. So we actually, the last vessel on our brew house here is called the whirlpool. And so we would pump it into the whirlpool, and in there it would actually just spin around for about a half hour. And the process of spinning it around would cause any hop matter, any proteins, to settle out into a nice firm cone in the bottom of the vessel. And so then when we go to transfer that wort from the whirlpool to the fermenter, we get nice clean wort, no protein, no hop matter in there. So coming out of the whirlpool, the wort would still be about 200 degrees. That's not really a temperature that yeast like. So we need to get it down to an appropriate temperature. We have a nice little heat exchanger here. And we would pump the wort out of the whirlpool through the heat exchanger, where it would. How would you describe that, Ben?
I don't know. It looks like
accordion all the way in.
There you go. It's like a sofa-sized accordion, maybe something like that.
That sounds good. A little bit like a radiator too.
There you go.
So what we would do, we'd pump the hot wort in one side, and then we would pull off of our. We have a large tank of cold water here. We would pump that in the other side. they pass by each other in thin sheets, kind of like a radiator, and then they would exchange temperature. So the wort would come out of the output side at about 65 degrees, and we would run that into our fermenter. And the cold water would come out the other side, usually about 140 degrees. We would actually recover that in our hot water tank, and that would become the water for the next brewing cycle.
Okay, so now you've got this pre-fermented beer you call wort that's at a nice temperature, and now that you've lowered the temperature, the yeast are ready to do their thing?
They are. We just haven't added them in into the fermenter yet. So we actually, as we get some of the wort into the fermenter, we would pump some yeast into that tank as well. And then from there, we kind of let the yeast steal the show.
So yeast is something every household works with, making bread or whatever. But what is yeast anyway?
So yeast is a tiny microorganism that would be almost everywhere. It's certainly in the air around us and probably on all surfaces. But in the brewing world, we're very specific about what yeasts we like to use. And it's something that's been cultured over thousands of years of brewing. Interestingly, in the original German purity law, they actually did not know that yeast was a component of beer, so they did not include that in allowable ingredients in beer. But so once we introduce the yeast to the wort, the yeast will start to consume the fermentable sugars we extracted from the barley, and then the byproducts from that process would be CO2 and alcohol.
Okay, I see the bubbling going on over there. The CO2, we don't really care about. It just goes off into the air. We're interested in the alcohol there, too. So that's what's happening in these two-story-sized fermenters. I see 1, 2, 3, 4 on this side. There are probably some others. And how many gallons would you say are these fermenters?
So these fermenters are 60 barrels in size, which means they're 1,800 gallons or 120 kegs worth of beer in each one.
Okay. So right now, these fermenters have beer in them right now? Is something happening right now or not?
Yeah, most of them. 4 of them have active beer in them. One is clean for tomorrow's brew, and the other one is empty. We drained it yesterday and finished that beer. So we'll get that cleaned up and ready for the next brew.
Okay, so the wort goes into the fermenter. The yeast are very happy. They reproduce. They throw off CO2 and alcohol. What do you do then?
So that process usually takes about 2 weeks in total. It'll be very active for 4 or 5 days where you'll see a lot of CO2 output bubbling, and we usually have buckets with sanitizer in them to allow all that CO2 to escape, and you'll see a lot of activity there. That'll settle down, and then we'll start to condition the beer to start preparing it to finish it. Mm-hmm. So after about 2 weeks, we would crash the temperature on the tank and bring it down to about 30 degrees. And that would help to sort of settle out and clarify the beer before we send it through for filtration.
Then is the beer done, or do you need to do some other things?
We still, it would be drinkable at that point, but it probably wouldn't be familiar to most people as what they know as finished beer. So our next step in the process would be to filter the beer. And one really nice piece of technology that we added here at our Iowa City Big Grove is our centrifuge. So centrifuges have been around for a long time, but they've only started to get involved in the craft brewing industry in the last 5 to 10 years.
Okay, so this is what we're standing in front of right now. This is a centrifuge. It looks like something a mad scientist would build in his garage or basement, right?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of pipes going this way and that, and hoses with water and CO2 and compressed air and everything else. It's tricky to make sense of when you first look at it, that's for sure. So what we would do, we would take the beer off the fermenter and we would pump it into our centrifuge here. It would come in and it actually goes up through this tube, and it's a stainless steel tube, and then halfway up there is what we call a sight glass. So it's just two pieces of glass on either side of the tube so we can see exactly how the beer looks going in there. That would be before it goes in and goes through the centrifuge. So as far as how this machine does its thing, it actually just spins at about 8,000 RPM. And so the beer will get pumped down into that bowl as it spins at 8,000 RPM, and that force would pull out any proteins, any yeast, any solids, and clarify our beer. So after it comes out of the bowl, it would come out of this other pipe here and go through another sight glass, and then we could see exactly what clarity level we've achieved with our centrifuge.
Okay, so after the centrifuge, where does our beer then go?
So then we just basically need a receiving tank. So out of the centrifuge, we would step over and we would connect our hoses into what we call bright tanks. And these bright tanks are also 60 barrels in size. They're a little different shape though. They don't have the conical bottom that the fermenters do. They're just a large cylinder. So we would pump all the batch in there. At that point, we would determine how much volume we netted from our batch. That way we could pay our taxes on it. And we would also finish it. We would let a couple days of final settling occur to bring it to true brightness. And then we would carbonate it up to the level of carbonation that we want.
Explain that a little bit. You determine the quantity, and then the state needs its due in taxes.
Sure. So every month we pay taxes to the state on what we produce. So they want a very accurate measurement of what we've done over the month. And so we've done some careful measurement of what this container holds at every point. And that way we can report accurately to them what we need to pay taxes on.
Okay. We're at the bright tank. Is it done?
So it is done. It is finished. We could start drinking it right off the bright if we wanted to, but that's kind of where we get to decision time. Where is that beer going to go? The sales department would probably like it all in kegs so they could sell it around the market. But Danny up in the tap house on site here would prefer to have it all in our serving cooler so he could sell it here. usually it's a mix. We'll divide the batch. We'll keg off about half, and we'll run the other half into our serving tanks in the serving cooler here. I think one of my favorite things about coming to the brewery and drinking a beer at the brewery is just it's such a short distance that the beer travels to get to your glass. I mean, we've essentially walked the distance that the beer travels. If we walked the rest of the 150 feet out to the tap handles out in the bar, that would be how far your beer had to travel to get to your glass. So fresh as it gets.
So Andy, before it gets out to find the patrons' glasses, what has to happen to it?
So back here we have our serving cooler, and that would house all of the beers that we serve in the tap room. It's just a big white box from the outside, but when I open this cooler door, most people's eyes light up and they get excited because all the beer's in here. So inside of our serving cooler here, we have eight large stainless steel tanks that each hold about 60 kegs worth of beer. And they're 15 feet tall and usually half to three quarters full. And those would connect directly to the taps up front. So like I said, we would just pump the beer over through hoses from that bright tank right into one of these serving tanks. And then bam, it would go on tap up front. It's a pretty impressive display.
So Andy, you've taken us through the brewing process here. I don't know, you and Danny, should we head out front and have a taste of a few of your brews?
Absolutely.
You've waited long enough. Let's do it. Let's do the fun stuff.
Okay. Yep. We're in the back bar now, and I'm looking at two dozen taps here. So we're going to try them out and see how, from very few ingredients. What did you say? How many ingredients do we have going into every one of these beers?
Four
ingredients. Okay, how we get so many different tastes. Let's see.
So okay. We can start out with a few of our lighter styles here. The first one that Danny poured for you is called Side Hill Sour. And this is actually, it's an old German style. It's a Berliner Weiss style beer. But we actually intentionally sour the wort before we boil it. So we use a lactobacillus culture in there to create that sour flavor. And then from there, we treat it pretty similar to our other beers.
Okay. Are you drinking? I'm not drinking alone, am I?
Sorry.
Okay, cheers.
Cheers. So as a part of this style, we use a lot of wheat. Gives it a nice pale golden color and a nice body to it.
Really good. It has, of course, a nice sour taste. Sour beers are up and coming, not to the extent that IPAs are, but they're taking hold, aren't they? They're becoming more and more popular.
They have caught on quite a bit. It's interesting too to me as we get out to a lot of beer festivals and events and just seeing who the sour beers appeal to. And a lot of times it'll be wine drinkers and people who don't think they like beer because it's such a different profile from your average, from an IPA or a Budweiser or whatever other style they might have tried.
It's kind of the fun discovery of it. It's always have people asking me, how do you sell them this beer? How do you sell them that beer? It's not about like selling it. It's how do you have someone discover what they like in beer, even if they don't like beer, they tell you they don't like beer, or they say they only like one style of beer. It's really kind of a fun process to throw something like the Side Hill Sour in front of somebody and just see their facial reaction and just like, wow, I didn't know you could do that with beer. Maybe I do like beer.
Okay, so in our mini tasting here, we're winding up with a very dark brew. This is called?
This is Zadar. It's our milk stout. So very dark and roasty, has some kind of coffee and roast notes in there. We always serve it on nitrogen here at the brewery, so it has a nice creamy cascading head on top of it. Very attractive beer.
So I've heard it's a lot like chemistry. If you're a good chemist, you'd be a good brewer. So you have to just control all the variables, and then really, it's going to work.
Yes, everything's always changing. I think that's one of the things people don't give enough credit to the brewing world for, is that it's an agricultural product. I mean, the barley malt and the hops that you get year to year, they're going to change. And so kind of keeping up with that and adjusting to that is definitely, skilled brewers are very good at that. But it is a lot like chemistry, and if you do the same thing the same way every time, then you end up with a consistent product.
What do Danny and Andy, what do you see in the future of this? The question out there is, when is this huge boom in craft beer, which has been growing by double digits every year for over a decade, when is the market saturated? What are your guesses on that?
I mean, as far as what I see from day to day, I still have people who are still discovering this. So until I see that slow down even a little bit, I couldn't even tell you, because it's still almost every day, every weekend, any time like that. It's just like more people coming in. Oh, I never tried craft beer. Oh, I didn't know I would like this. And all of a sudden they're hooked. So until I stop seeing that, it's going to keep growing, I believe.
It's a hard question to answer, but I think part of it is the craft beer pie, part of the pie, has been so small that growth has been easily achieved. And there's still potentially so many people, like Danny said, who haven't even really been exposed to it, or maybe not in the right way. And so I think there's a lot of room for growth. And as long as the quality of the beer is there, I think that a lot of these breweries will sustain.
Okay. Danny Stanley, managing partner, Andy Joint, head brewer of Big Grove Brewing at the new operation of the Solon-based brewery here in Iowa City. Thanks for giving us a tour, guys.
Thanks for coming down.
Thanks, Ben.
Coming up after a short break, a big picture look at the economics behind the locally produced and consumed products like beer, wine, and other distilled liquors with economist Dave Swenson. Also a conversation with Iowa's so-called Minister of Beer, Jay Wilson. That's when River to River continues. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a moment. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Confluence, Lion Bridge, Peace Tree, Back Pocket, Toppling Goliath. If you recognize any in this odd assortment of names, you're likely a craft beer drinker. This hour, we've been giving you an update on the business of craft brewing in the state. In the first half hour, if you were along with us, a visit to a huge expansion of Big Grove Brewing. That's a Solon-based brewer. Their expansion in Iowa City really upping the capacity to roughly 10 times of what it was because of the demand for locally brewed craft beers. All across the country, craft beer production has been growing by leaps and bounds, double-digit sales growth year after year, also here in Iowa. In just a few minutes, a conversation with Iowa's so-called Minister of Beer, Jay Wilson. Also later, we'll visit with one of the owners and the founders of 515 Brewing Company. It's a microbrewery in Des Moines. But first, let's spend a few minutes talking about the economics of locally produced beer, as well as wine, distilled spirits. Dave Swenson is with us, Associate Scientist of Economics at Iowa State University. Dave, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So what is it through your lens as an economist, this craft brewing boom we've been having for more than a decade across the nation and here in Iowa?
Sure. Well, it's craft brewing and also wineries and vineyards, the expansion of those, and then of late we have distilleries popping up. They're part of a local foods, local consumption movement. And the local foods, local consumption movement is it has many parts to it. Part of it's nutrition, part of it's try to support farmers, part of it's trying to support new or fledgling businesses. But the whole point of it is to try to get people to buy goods and services. In his case, we're talking about foodstuffs and beverages locally. Now, the idea in the local foods movement is that you're producing the foods on the farm and you're either selling them to farmers markets or into restaurants or back into the grocery store and the wholesale system. The point there is that we are substituting for goods, in this case, foods, and what we're talking about here today, wine and other kinds of spirits and beer, we're substituting locally produced goods and services or locally produced goods for something that we used to import. And when I say import, I mean from Milwaukee or La Crosse or St. Louis mm-hmm. in the case of beer. So when that dollar leaves the state, that dollar's gone. It has trouble finding its way back in the state. But when we spend a dollar locally, that dollar gets to travel around just a little bit. That dollar supports jobs locally that are producing that product. In the case of local foods, whether it's on the farm or in the case of beer, it's the jobs that are in the brewery. Or in the vineyards. Okay, so those jobs, those are incomes that are being generated in the state that allow for more consumption within the state by households. Plus, these businesses are buying inputs. They have what we call an indirect effect. They need inputs. They need energy. They need water. They need, in the case of beer, they're going to need hops. They're going to need
barley,
malted barley, exactly, yes. And other types of things to affect the flavors. And again, the degree to which those are produced in Iowa, that ends up being what we call an import substitution. The more we can produce, buy, put together, fabricate, and then redistribute and consume here in Iowa, we get a nice little multiplier. Mm. When the dollars leave the state, there's no multiplier. Actually, there is a multiplier. There's a minus sign in front of it.
Okay,
when the money stays in the state, it's beneficial to the regional economy.
Okay. So what's interesting here, and I don't know if you'd looked at this, is the decision people make when they buy locally produced products, they consume them locally. I mean, people going to this brewery, creating jobs. I was surprised the brewery we had a tour of in their first half hour, Big Grove, the expansion in Iowa City, approximately 100 jobs, most of those in the front end in the service, but a lot of those people involved with the actual brewing of some 10 different beers here. When you go in as a customer, all I can tell is that the people say, this tastes really good. I like it. It's different. I'm a fan. Or do we know more about people buying local because they feel good about the jobs they're creating?
Yeah, I don't know. I think that, well, what I do know in the local foods movement, it's a combination of things, but it is people who feel good about, they have an attachment to their community, attachment to their region. There's another thing, though, that we know about people who patronize these kinds of places or buy these kinds of products. They tend to have more discretionary income than the average household. These places tend to be, the more successful places tend to be in and or on the fringe of metropolitan markets where you do have higher levels of discretionary income and higher demand for a range of entertainment opportunities and amenities. And so there's an intersection of these things. They tend to be in metropolitan areas, not exclusively, of course, but they tend to be in metropolitan areas, or they tend to be in places where people go because it's a destination for recreation or it's a destination for entertainment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, to put a five spot, $5 down for a beer, that's not in everyone's budget, right?
No, it's not in everyone's budget. And so this industry, like many industries, has to really, focus on both geographically and demographically where its customer base is. And to be strategic and to be successful, these companies have to know what they're doing. You can't put probably one of these things in the middle of Northwest Iowa and expect it to succeed. But you can put it someplace perhaps in and around or near Dallas County, near West Des Moines, and hope for it. You have a pretty good chance of one of these operations succeeding.
Dave, quickly before we have to go in just a few seconds, tell me, what is the growth outlook? I mean, we're talking about beer. What this whole sector here, have we plateaued? Will it plateau?
Well, I don't know if it's plateaued. Really, that sector is going to grow to the degree that discretionary income grows in the state, especially in and around metropolitan areas. And those areas of the state are doing much better than the rest of the state. So my expectation would be positive.
Okay, thanks very much. Dave Swenson, economist at Iowa State University. We appreciate your insights, Dave.
You're welcome.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, looking at different perspectives of Iowa's craft beer industry continuing to boom to create jobs. Now joining us, the so-called Minister of Iowa Beer at the Iowa Brewers Guild, Jay Wilson, returns to our program. Hi, Jay.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great to have you in our Des Moines studio. Take us back very quickly. We have 7 or 8 minutes to talk, but how did this get sparked, this whole brewing craft brewing passion? How did it come to life here in Iowa?
You know, all this talk about local foods movement is definitely part of it. A lot of people have discovered beer in one place or another and decided, well, if I can't get good beer here, I'll brew it myself. That's certainly how I got deeper and deeper into it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, eventually those people became so good at it and so savvy and so crazy that perhaps, hey, maybe I can make a living out of this. And so slowly you see homebrewers transitioning into the professional realm, and here we are today.
Mm-hmm. How would you describe the growth that we've seen? I don't know if you have any data there specific to Iowa compared to the rest of the nation. All the states are going crazy, bonkers about craft beer.
Oh, absolutely. Nationwide, you know, it's about 12% market share at this point. You know, it was a fraction of that 10 years ago. So, but in Iowa specifically, to take a national average of 12% market share, we've got about 6% market share that is craft brewed beer. What is the market share in all of Iowa? Only 1% of that, by the way, is produced here in Iowa. So as far as like saturation of these locally produced projects, I would say that we're quite a long ways away from that. There's lots of room to grow.
Mm-hmm. What insights, what can you tell us about the economic impact, jobs? How many breweries Iowa has created in the last few years? How many jobs in those breweries?
Sure. So we have about 75 breweries in the state today with a number of breweries in planning. So there's more coming. Back in 2014, or it came out in 2015, but the Iowa Wine and Beer Promotion Board funded an economic impact study on Iowa craft beer. Taking numbers from 2014, we produced about 41,000 barrels of beer, a barrel being 31 gallons. The projections, the five-year projection to get us to 2019 was that we would more than triple up to about 146,000 barrels of beer. The following year was about 55,000. Last year was about 61,000 barrels of beer. So we're definitely on an upward trajectory. And, you know, so I definitely see that happening. You talked about Big Grove in the first part of the program. There are a number of similar sized expansions all over the state in cities and small communities alike, Lake Time in Clear Lake, Keg Creek in Glenwood. Just like we list them off, you know, one after the other. So there's a lot of growth happening and more to be had for sure.
Mm-hmm. What does it take to start a brewery? What are the different sizes? There's micro. There's even one smaller than micro, isn't there?
Well, they have what they call a nano brewery.
That's probably
3, 5, maybe 7 barrel system. There are an awful lot of those around the state. People ask me about saturation point, that sort of thing, an awful lot. And I think, you know, you really don't think about how many breweries we have. Think about how much beer they're making. So we can certainly have an awful lot of 3-barrel systems. We can have an awful lot of 10-barrel systems in the state. Can we have an awful lot of 100-barrel systems in the state? No, and we probably won't have an awful lot of those. We've got, you know, one that's broken ground and in the works right now up in Decorah in Toppling Goliath. But there won't be lots, you know, of breweries that are that size.
Mm-hmm. Jay, I lived a good deal of time in Germany over a decade. And what was remarkable there, it was before our beer revolution took place here in North America to a large degree. It was in the 1980s. And what was remarkable there was that communities drank their own beer. Cologne drinks Kölsch. Dusseldorf is Altbier. And so people there just grew up drinking their particular style of beer. Are we edging toward that where okay, you've named the percentages are pretty small here, but that you drink the beer from where you come?
Yes, definitely. We're returning to a time before Prohibition. That was totally the case. You know, we have 75 breweries in the state right now. In the 1800s, we had up to 150 breweries in the state and quite a bit smaller population. So to get, you know, concerned about the number 75 and think we're saturated, you know, that just doesn't really, you know, jive with reality for me. So,
it's not a record number of breweries. It's half what we had in the 1800s.
Think about
the population in the middle 1800s.
Exactly. Right. So, you know, we certainly have the ability to distribute further. We've got refrigerated trucks and all that good stuff nowadays, and you can send beer further away. I think one challenge is, Andy or somebody from Big Grove there hit the nose on the head. You know, quality is important. If you're going to continue in today's market, you better have really good beer. But in addition to that, I think that emphasis on local products is going to be more and more important. If you've got good beer locally, you're going to probably, you know, buy that beer locally. If I'm in Iowa City and I want a beer, you know, those guys are good guys. They make really high quality beer. I'm going to go to Big Grove and I'm going to support those guys.
Mm-hmm.
If you're an out-of-state brewery, I don't think it's a slam dunk for a well-known brewery in Colorado or California or Michigan or wherever to just send beer to Iowa and expect that it's going to sell without some support. If there's some really solid beers in the state of Iowa that's produced down the street, most people are going to try those beers first. And so it's the out-of-staters that are going to have, you know, sort of a new challenge before them as the market continues to evolve.
And we probably should mention, Jay, shouldn't we, that the big breweries have been getting into the act. They see this trend here. So not when you go to this supermarket shelf and you think, oh, that looks like a craft beer, not necessarily from a small brewery, is it?
That's definitely an issue that we're seeing more and more of, yes.
Mm-hmm. Jay Wilson is a minister of beer, so-called minister of beer. I guess it's a fancy way of saying executive director at the Iowa Brewers Guild. Is that right, Jay?
Yes, it's a fancy way to spell executive director.
Also joining us in the Des Moines studio, Dave Rupte is one of the owners and co-founders of 515 Brewing Company. That's a microbrewery in Des Moines. Dave, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So give us, we have just 5 minutes or so left of the program. Give us a little introduction to your brewery, how it got started, what it looks like today.
Sure. So there's four owners in the company, and we got together around 2010 or so. All were home brewers, and we thought, hey, we need some more options for beer in Des Moines at the time. We just had, I think, the four brew pubs operating in the area. So we got together and found a location on the bike trail and built a little tiny nano brewery there. And we opened that in 2013, and so we just celebrated our fourth anniversary here a couple months ago, and we upgraded our system. We're now, I would consider us a microbrewery.
So from nano to micro, congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, it's massive growth.
How many employees do you have, Dave?
We have three full-time employees and then about another five or six part-time folks that work in the tap room there for us.
Mm-hmm. So is it the case that this is a neighborhood brewery? People swing around with their growlers when they're empty. Growlers, for those who don't know, are these containers you put beer in, usually 64 ounces, something like that?
Absolutely. What we're seeing in the marketplace is this kind of bifurcation of the market into larger production breweries like what Big Grove has just built, and then smaller neighborhood, essentially they're tiny brew pubs with or without food. And we're definitely on that tiny brew pub side of things where we're produce about 80% of our beer we produce is sold on premise there in our tap room. And mm-hmm. a little bit goes outside to other bars and restaurants.
How many beers do you make, different types?
Depends on the week. We don't really have a set production schedule. We have maybe five or six that we try and keep around most of the time, but we've done about 30, I think, now, mm-hmm. different flavors for different times of the year and different reasons.
Dave, I wonder how you think, and this is a question also for Jay as well, how you think American beers compare in the meantime to European beers? We always look to the Germans, the Belgians,
sure.
The English. How do we measure up here in America now?
I can tell you from anecdotal evidence, at least, that we have become at least on par, at least in most consumers outside of here, with the German and English and Belgian traditions of beer, with the new and innovative stuff, the hops that we're using that no one else is using, and the barrel-aged beers and things of that nature. It's become kind of its own unique thing, which, you know, is pretty fantastic.
Yeah, unimaginable, say, three decades ago that we would be on par because, well, we still have most of the country drinking mass-produced beer from St. Louis, Milwaukee, Kansas City, right?
Sure. And I will note in the last few years, Peachtree down in Knoxville won the gold medal for their Belgian ale against other Belgian breweries, and Lionbridge has recently won.
That would have to be Blonde Fatale.
Yeah, Blonde Fatale from Peachtree.
I know it well.
And yeah, we all do, I think.
Jay Wilson, what do you think about the American-European beer comparison?
Well, I would agree with what Dave said. You know, there were a few years ago where when you said American beer and people would have, you know, overseas would have a pretty low opinion of that. Not that those mass-produced light lagers were poorly executed, but just they didn't have any flavor, and they still don't today. Now, that's completely flip-flopped. And I would say that we're, you know, sending influence back across the pond. Mm-hmm. They're starting to, and you know, if you go to London right now, you can get an American-style American Pale Ale, APA, IPA, that's using Northwest hops and has those, you know, piney flavors or citrusy right. types of flavors. So we're sending influence back over there. For sure.
I mean, my experience is that knowing your European brews too is that since this has happened, if you're someone who only knows craft beer in the United States, good craft beer, and you go over to Europe, you might come across some of those lagers and say this is kind of mediocre, not mediocre in terms of brewing, just kind of not an exciting experience. The exciting experience you might have here in craft brewing.
I think some people appreciate a well-executed beer. At every, you know, Americans, we've got to shove more of everything, more and bigger and better, and that's not always good. So I would say that if I got to go to Munich, you know, this week and was tasting beers over there, man, I would really appreciate the subtlety. Now, somebody else might not quite be ready to appreciate that subtlety, but boy, I do.
You don't always want that hammer of hops on your tongue.
Yeah, you can't sit around and drink that stuff all the time.
I will note that Jake speaks for himself, perhaps, there.
Says IPA guy Dave.
We have a couple minutes left, Jay and Dave here. What about this idea of saturation, of reaching a plateau? I like the comment in their first half hour from Danny Stanley, the managing partner at Big Grove Brewing. He said, you know, as long as I have people coming in, I guess I don't think he used the word convert, but people coming in never having tried craft brews, they come in the door, they take their first drink, and wow, it's something they've never experienced before. As long as he continues to see that, he doesn't see a reason for growth to stop?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we're going to see growth fragment across the country. We've kind of had a lot of huge growth across the whole nation, but in Iowa in particular, I think, you know, we're like 41st in the nation right now in gallons produced per capita for 21 plus adult, and you know, I think there's still a lot of room to grow there, and I think that's also as the younger generation that's used to choice comes up. I don't think they're going to want less choice in the marketplace. They're going to keep wanting more choice and where and how and the brands that they consume, and I think there's, you know, there's a lot of undeveloped market here in Iowa, and I think that's where you're going to see growth across the nation is in underdeveloped markets that people are just starting to kind of discover, and I think Iowa clearly fits in that bucket.
Jay Wilson, before we go, we've got about a minute left. Didn't mention legislation. Have we had some legislation that's recently that's helped out this area, also in spirits, no? Distilled
yes,
spirits.
Absolutely. House File 607 was just signed by the governor a week or two ago, and Dave was on the task force, a very comprehensive, you know, look at the alcohol industry in Iowa and all the bits and pieces that go into it. So a couple of things help us out. It's a little easier and less cumbersome for brew pubs to sell growlers. And starting on July 1, native brewery license holders will be able to sell wine at retail there, so we can have a broader offering for folks. Not everybody drinks beer or can drink beer.
Mm-hmm. All right, and we always want to encourage people, of course, to drink responsibly and safely. That goes without saying. I'll say it anyway.
Absolutely.
Dave, where do you hope to be in 5 or 10 years with 515 Brewing?
Oh, boy, that's a really tough question. I don't know. right now, we're kind of just watching how the market goes, and we don't want to grow too fast or irresponsibly.
Keep that quality up.
Keep the quality up and making sure that, you know, I think in the long run, executing a business plan that is executable and that sustainable and that, you know, that the quality is good and the customer service is good are really the most important things for any business and certainly ours as well. So we're just going to kind of focus on the quality and trying to stay small right now, I think is our goal.
Jay Wilson, when you look at the whole state, just a few seconds left, 75 breweries today in Iowa. Are we going to top the 150 approximate breweries we had in 1850 anytime soon?
Not anytime soon. We'll see what happens. But I'd say 75 breweries in the state of Iowa. Go to Portland, Oregon, one city. They've got 75 breweries there. Go to San Diego, California. They got more than 75 breweries there. So we certainly have room for more breweries.
Okay. Thank you very much, Jay Wilson of the Iowa Brewers Guild, Dave Rupte of the 515 Brewing Company in Des Moines. Thanks, gentlemen, for helping us out today.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.